Good morning, everyone. I just found out today is Jagadhatri Puja Day. Yeah, so one of the many ways in which the Divine Mother is worshipped. It was a very important day in the life of the Holy Mother, especially. And this is the main celebration worship that's done in Jagadhatri, even today. And yesterday was the 150th birth anniversary of Sister Nivedita. All sorts of big celebrations going on in India. I think the inauguration of her the house where she lived in Bagh Bazar taking place today. So it's a good day for a few reasons. I started this series earlier this month on the motto, what we call the motto of the Ramakrishna Order, the Mutton Mission, that we have this twin motto, that we strive for our own liberation and we work for the welfare of the world. And I tried to show last time that something that sounds as wonderful and simple as this also can be problematic in its own way, that If we examine this against some of the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, some of the things that Swamiji himself said, we find that if we really want to play devil's advocate, we can find reasons to question both of these as really our goals of life, working for the welfare of others. If we read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, we see that Thakur many times would say, "Who are you to help the world? God himself will look after the world." And this idea of for one's own liberation, we will find many times that Swamiji is saying, don't seek your own liberation. Better to work for the welfare of others. So what I'm trying to do, and this it'll be a three-part series, is to clean it up a little bit, to kind of sharpen our understanding of these concepts so that we can see that, yes, it is a beautiful ideal, that despite some superficial difficulties with it, if we get to the heart of it and we really see what's meant by this, that these are two beautiful guiding principles for each and every life, not simply the monks of the order, but devotees and for everyone. And not only that, but they're not two separate things. That we'll see how they work together. We need one to balance the other. We need one to actually implement the other. So last time I kind of introduced this topic, and today I want to deal with the specific half of this that talks about for one's own liberation, Atmano Moksha Tam. We find that this idea is unquestioned throughout the whole Vedantic tradition, religious tradition, this mumukshatvam, this desire for liberation. It's considered to be essential, that we need it at the very beginning. We read in Vivek Chudamani that it's through the grace of God that we get this longing for liberation. Throughout the Gita, throughout all of the texts, Vedanta Sara, all of these, we find that moksha parayana in Gita, that we have to have this as a goal of life. We know with the four aims of life that this is the final one. This is the guiding and ruling one that we all come to. If during the earlier stages of life, it's not the specific goal. If during the householder stage of life, we have the different aims of enjoyment and accumulation of wealth, this is lurking there waiting for us to get through the other two, and this will be the ultimate aim of life. But we find that even this raises a few little questions. Should this be the ultimate aim of life? First of all, what do we mean by liberation? And this is something that I think most people, if you try to pin them down, they'll end up saying, I have no idea. And if we look at the tradition, Vedanta, all of the different schools, they also have their own idea. So there's nothing very fixed and easy to understand about this. But if we take it in general, to mean at the very least, this puts an end to this round of birth and death. At the very least, if generally that'll be agreed upon, then we have to ask, is this a selfish ideal? Is there something pessimistic about this? Does it mean that this life is such a horrible thing that all we want to do is make sure that we don't have to go through it again? Is this really the pinnacle of our spiritual beliefs and outlook on the world? Is it escapist? So we have these questions do arise. And much of it, of course, depends on what we mean by this idea of moksha, this idea of liberation. How does it fit in with the idea of an afterlife, if we even believe in something like that? And of course, this depends on what belief. Do we have a belief in the soul? Do we have a belief in karma? Some scholars, all of these different things. And even when we feel that it's a question of the afterlife, what about liberation while living? This is this jivan mukti. This is considered one of the great ideals that we have in Vedanta. Is that what we're really seeking? Or see, we have two, videha mukti and jivan mukti. Are we really concerned about putting an end to all of this, or do we want something here and now? So these are some of the questions I want to examine, the different ways that we have of understanding mukti or moksha, liberation, as a metaphysical doctrine and as a goal of life. Do we really feel that this is our ultimate goal and aim of life? And what did Swamiji mean? What was in his mind? What was his understanding? And how does it line up in accord with what he learned from Sri Ramakrishna? So these are a few of the things that I want to look at with this idea of mukti. We have something which is a little bit different in the Vedantic tradition and, of course, the Buddhist traditions, others that grew out of it, this idea that we don't have to wait until death to have this experience. So it's not just some final liberation idea. It's some enlightenment concept that we have, this idea of jivan mukti, that we have a certain experience which allows us to live in this world as free beings, without any bonds. And if we do that, then the second part, this videha mukti, this liberation when the body falls, that's assured. So we can get the first without the second. We can get the second without the first. We could attain final liberation at the final moment of life. But if we get it while living, if we get it here and now, then there's no more rebirth according to the Vedantic understanding of all of this. So we find generally that this second ideal, that the end of this round of birth and death, that this is something that seems to be emphasized more. We may find out that really it's the first one that's really important, and this is why we have such emphasis on here and now, to try to realize God, realize this self, realize truth, this very moment. This is what we're really striving for. So to me, I think we'll find that this will be the more important aspect of this idea of mukti. Let's start with the videha mukti. This what happens when this life ends. This life ends and we've attained the goal. We'll assume that there's something that will come at the end of this, either at the end of this round of birth and death, or for religious traditions that believe in one lifetime, that for them, automatically, whatever comes after that is the afterlife. Whether it's a heaven or a hell, or whether there's nothing, that'll be, right? Maybe nothing. Yeah. This is also a position. We can say the atheistic position. It's a metaphysical position. There's no soul, so there's nothing. We have whole schools of Buddhism that will believe this, that nirvana is really blowing out the flame. There's nothing left that can be reborn. So this is also one of the possibilities. But virtually every tradition will have some idea. The atheists have their idea, the theists have their idea, the non-dualists have their own idea of what happens. A lot of it will be with the personal God, a lot of it for the non-dualistic Vedantins, it'll be all dealing with this impersonal absolute. And really, this is something that one of my college professors told me once, that at the heart of all the quarrels between all the different schools of Vedanta, this is the real thing. It's not so much, is the world real or is it unreal? Is it like a dream? It's not so much, is there one soul or many souls? What happens after liberation? The dualists don't like this idea at all, that they won't be around anymore. They'll have merged. And the non-dualists think it's very silly, this idea, that there'll be some continuation of something like this, only it'll be beautiful and wonderful. So this quarrel comes between these different schools, between, aside from the other metaphysical things, but this very practical question, what is liberation? What are we trying to get out of all of this? If we think that there's something to be attained, aside from the joy of spirituality in this very lifetime, if we think there's something to be attained in future lifetime, what will it be like? And as I say, all the different devotional schools, they'll have their own understanding, and the non-theistic schools also. In the Western tradition, we'll end up with this idea of salvation versus damnation. You have two options. You either go up or you go down. Whether it's really up or down, of course, we don't know. It's kind of like these maps, you know, north is up and south is down. It's a very arbitrary thing. I remember when I went to Australia, they have maps that are reversed just for fun. Yeah, because there's no reason why north. Anyhow, this is completely beside the point. But this idea of salvation. So in the West we have that idea. In the Eastern traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, some others like that, everything has to do with whether we put an end to this round or whether we continue. And of course there'll be concepts of the heavens and hells and things that'll be temporary. So Swamiji was very scientific. He says there can't be an eternal result to a temporary cause. If there's a finite cause, the result has to be finite. If everything is the result of our karma, that was finite, that has to be exhausted. And then what's keeping this idea of heaven going anymore? So this idea of rebirth, of course, this is what everything hinges on, that each lifetime, if we're not realizing God, at least we're purifying the soul. At least we're gaining in understanding. We're gaining in sattva, in purity and goodness and everything. And the struggle goes on lifetime after lifetime. And everything is, we have this very nice phrase from the Kathopanishad, yata karma, yata shrutam. It means that everything that we do and everything we experience will help shape who we are, and that who we are, however we understand that, is what will leave this body and take a new body or take a subtle body, however the whole thing works, that this is how things get, how this experience becomes the catalyst for whatever future experience we will have. So these are the things that shape us and form us, everything we do and everything we experience. Some things we do unknowingly, there may be some result. Things we do knowingly, this is what shapes character. So these are the things we have to give way to, place emphasis on. Something like this idea of this wave theory. And this is where the Hindu tradition and Buddhist tradition will give slightly different interpretations. But if you ever look at a wave, if you do some wave watching in the ocean, and you see that one wave, it'll seem to disappear, and then it'll come back again. It goes under, it seems to go underneath the surface. It's really just the surface changing shape, but it looks like the same wave, all coming into the shore, and the Vedantic idea will be that same wave is coming back, re-emerging, in a slightly different form, a little less force because it's getting closer to the shoreline. The Buddhist idea will be that forget about trying to find the same water molecules in the second wave, but it's the force and shape of that first wave that will define and determine the second wave. So either way we understand it, there's this idea, but it all will end. It will reach the shore one day. This is that common idea. So these are this idea of rebirth and everything. This is based on a very fundamental principle that there's no loss of anything, whether the energy and matter. If there's anything that has some existence, it can't disappear. So things can go from active to potential, mass to energy, like that, but they won't disappear. If the self, the real self, is pure consciousness, it'll have to enter into pure consciousness. If the body is matter, it'll go back to matter. If there's some subtle element here, it'll go back to the subtle elements. But what we do is not lost. This is the idea of karma, that effect will be there until it manifests itself somehow. And then we want to transform ourselves so that the cause becomes different in nature and the effect will also become different in nature. So this is what we're doing, this whole process. And there can be very radical transformation. We're trying to start from something very gross in nature and get more and more subtle. We can think of it in terms of how a diamond is created. How is a diamond created? Just from ferns and other green things, very prehistoric things, that they get crushed, and through billions of years, they turn into carbon, and some of billions of years, they get compressed, and they turn into this beautiful, clear, crystal diamond. So This is that process. We're starting out like these simple ferns that are growing in the ground and the marshy areas and everything, and we're trying to turn ourselves into diamonds. So this is the idea of the jiva, and again, a very problematical concept. Is there an individual soul, not an individual soul? Sometimes we'll think in terms of just this subtle body, this mind. This is how this mind is being formed. So we're all participating in this process of fulfilling our ultimate potential, because the diamond will be existing in that fern itself. It exists in a very potential form, and we're trying to turn ourselves into pure, crystalline, sparkling, shiny diamonds that way. Now, with all of these confusing ideas about what happens when the soul leaves the body, if there's a soul, and takes on a new body, Swamiji gives us a completely different way of looking at this, which is very, very beautiful. He talks about thinking of ourselves as the point of reference. We don't go anywhere. Everything comes in front of us. It appears before us. So he says it's like reading a book. That each page of the book will be another day, each chapter will be another lifetime, and one after another, we go until we finish reading the book, and then we remain where we always were, and everything else falls off. So no coming and going, no entering into new bodies, but experiencing, everything is experiencing one lifetime after another. He says, I am omnipresent, eternal. Where can I go? Where am I not already? I am reading this book of nature. Page after page, I'm finishing and turning over, and one dream of life after another goes away. Another page of life is turned, another dream of life comes, and it goes away, rolling and rolling. And when I finish my reading, I let go and stand aside. I throw away the book, and the whole thing is finished. So we have these different ways of looking at this. This finishing. This finishing is what we mean by mukti or moksha. And after that, no more reading of the book, no more going here and there, no more entering into bodies. This puts an end to the whole thing, which, of course, doesn't help us much because we still don't know what that means. Putting an end to it means we may not come back to this plane again. Does it mean we have some eternal life on a different plane? Does it mean our individuality is gone? What does it mean? So we see that every different tradition has its own understanding of this, his own solution to this problem, and maybe they're all right. Maybe it's a very subjective thing that those who think that, yes, this life is over, I'll find myself on the banks of the Yamuna, and I'll be sitting there with the cowherd boys and the gopis, and all joy and bliss. Krishna will be playing his flute. Maybe that's the experience they'll have, because this is the desire of their heart. We don't know how, if we're in the realm of the purely subjective, the purely objective, or some mixture. This is uncharted territory for all of us. We find in our own order a very strong belief in this Ramakrishna Loka. You won't find this in the listed among all of the others, Surya, Chandra, Pitri Loka, all of these things. But those, if this is the desire of the heart, and we attain to some very high states of realization, why shouldn't this be the experience that we have? It may not be permanent. It may be, you know, there's this idea of karma mukti, another interesting idea. Those who attain to knowledge and wisdom, enlightenment in this very lifetime, but still have a little of this punya left that has to be worked out, they'll go to some brahmaloka state. And then on the exhaustion of that merit, then they merge. So this may be our brahmaloka that we go for some time, and then even from there, we attain to that state of oneness. So there may be something subjective. Our beliefs, our concept of God, and our idea of the soul, maybe all of these do help determine the nature of the experience. Maybe not. We don't know. The one thing we can all agree upon is that this is highly mysterious stuff. We may also agree that it's not worth spending too much time on. That's the other thing. If we don't know about it, we assume that it's a good thing. That's all. Nahi kalyana krit kastya dorgatim tadagachiti, the beautiful line from this Gita. Don't worry about it. Just take it from me that nothing bad will happen. It'll be a nice thing. That we don't have to think that, oh, this is all it is. I could have had so much fun on earth. Instead, I denied myself of all of these things. Yeah, we should assume that that won't happen. Now, what about the non-dualists? If it's true, as the non-dualists say, that this soul, this individual soul, is not really an individual soul, that this is just the apparent reflection, that each and every one of us is really that Brahman, then it stands to reason that the state of final liberation will mean that Brahman alone remains. But I am that. So what does that mean? That there's some state of awareness, there's some feeling of oneness, there's some feeling of joy, ananda. Can we understand this from an impersonal point of view? It's very difficult. And we wonder how the non-dualists will long for that state, certainly not the way the dualists will long to have that experience of oneness with the personal God that way. But if we understand that the state of nirvikalpa samadhi and the state of final liberation for the non-dualists are more or less equivalent, and I think they are. I think this will be our closest way of understanding what it means to have final merging in Brahman. It'll be that individual merging in Brahman in that state of nirvikalpa samadhi. We know that when those who come down from that state are filled with bliss and filled with joy, they can't say anything about it. They can't explain what it was like, that I wasn't really present at that time, but we see the results of it. Their faces shining, full of bliss and full of joy. So this is as much as we can say, and probably too much. We probably can't even say this much. But ultimately, the Advaitin will have to say that we're already one with Brahman, we're already free, only we're in a state of ignorance. We're trying to get rid of all of that. We're trying to get beyond that maya, to at least throw off this idea of duality, this idea that we're separate from other people, this idea that we're finite, weak, limited beings, to feel that oneness with everything. Now, when we get to the qualified non-dualists and the dualists, we see that everything is different, because there isn't this idea that really Brahman alone exists. There is some idea in the jiva. There'll be different interpretations, but still, if the jiva is something real, then it has to continue in the state of final liberation also. So this allows these the dualists to have these different concepts. And we find that some of the schools will give different types of liberation. The dualistic school that's connected with the Chaitanya movement. This is actually, they're one of these Bheda-Bheda-Vadas. This is a difference in non-difference. It's kind of a combination of them. They talk about five different types of mukti, of liberation. Salokya. That means we'll end up in the same loka, that we won't get mixed up. We're worshiping Rama, we won't go to the Durga place. That we'll go in the same place. Samipya, and we won't be sitting far away in a corner, we'll be close. We'll get a front row seat, Samipya. Sarupya, that we'll also have this similar form that way. Everything will be in some subtle form, of course, but there'll be some similar form. Sadharmya, we'll have the same types of qualities. Limited, of course, but we'll also attain to that type of sweetness and joy and love that whatever the deity that we worship has. And Sayujya is where we merge with them. The dualists don't like this one. This is considered the lowest. The one that's considered the highest by the non-dualists, it's considered to be the lowest of them. They admit that that's possible, but they don't like it. This is like poison to them. That if you tell them, no, your individuality will leave you at that time, you won't have that slight separation to enjoy that experience of union. Even union requires separation. Even to feel that we've joined together, we have to be one, and there has to be someone that we join with. So if they say that won't be there, we'll say, well, I don't want it then. So I don't want to become sugar. I want to taste sugar. I want to enjoy it. Sri Ramakrishna had this attitude. See, a lot of this is attitude. It's not really metaphysics. It's not really metaphysics because we're guessing at all of this stuff. What is it that appeals to us? What is that idea that drives us? If I really long to have the vision of God, to be sit on the lap of Mother, and somebody says no, that you'll be merged in Brahman, then all of the incentive and joy of my spiritual practice leaves. So we need to cling to these ideas as we get closer to the goal. They may change also. Our understanding may get a little bit subtler and a little more deep than this. So anyhow, these dualistic and some qualified non-dualistic ideas, they're a little bit more like this Western conception of heaven, that there will be some experience. We may reunite with our loved ones. A lot of these things that the non-dualists accept as temporary, they may accept as some permanent thing. For the non-dualists, we also may go to Pitri Loka, be reunited with our loved ones, but it won't be permanent. They can have some permanent heaven. This is their little special feature that they have. Now, the Buddhist schools are also very interesting because there are some that really deny the soul idea at all. So for them, it is just an end, a complete cessation of life. That there is no more birth, and this kind of requires a very strong belief that everything is a dukkha, everything is suffering here. And that ultimately, if we analyze it, better not to go through all of this. A little bit pessimistic. We were talking earlier today about this Swami Gyaneshwaranandaji. He was the founder of the Vedanta Society in Chicago many, many years ago. I read a book about him once, and he used to say, I don't understand this longing never to be born again. If we have love and devotion, what a joy this life can be. If we're servants of a Thakur and Mother in this lifetime, what a joy to do that life after life after life. It's a very beautiful way of putting it. So it does have a little pessimistic side to it if we just think, let me get out of all of this. It means that really So I won't mention the suicide word, but anyhow, the people can start thinking like that. There was one group in the very early days, I don't know what period, called it Samsara Mochakas. Yeah. They thought that the greatest service they could do was to kill other people. Release, because they didn't believe in any afterlife or anything like that, but this life was awful. So you killed somebody, you're releasing them for the suffering of this lifetime. It wasn't a very popular sect. But anyhow, this shows that there can be this very escapist type of element to this longing for liberation also. Now, Gita, we find a nice mixture. The Gita, we know, contains all of the beautiful ideas from the Upanishad, but it also has this very personal aspect to it. There's a belief in a personal God, and especially this idea of liberation. We have so many different verses that talk about when we attain to Sri Krishna himself. If we can realize God in that personal form, then there's no more rebirth. We even have this idea of this sadharmya. This mama sadharmya agataha, that we attain to this state where we've also lost all of these rajasic and sattvic things, and we're tamasic things, and we're purely sattvic, the way God is purely sattvic, that way. The eighth chapter of Gita deals especially with this idea of liberation. And we find some nice verses. Reaching the highest perfection and having attained me. So it puts it in personal terms. It means realizing God. The great souled ones are no more subject to rebirth, which is the abode of pain and ephemeral. So we have these two things. There is anitya. There's nothing to hold on to. Everything is fleeing from us, is running away from us, our possessions, our near and dear ones, everything. So it's full of pain. Then all the worlds, O Arjuna, including the realm of Brahma, are subject to return. But after attaining me, O son of Kunti, there is no more rebirth. And what is called unmanifested and imperishable has been described as the supreme goal. That is my highest state, having attained which there is no return. So whether it's really different from the Advaitic point of view, or it's simply couched in personal language, it's difficult to say. But we have that same idea that we achieve something in this very lifetime which secures for us this final liberation. So they who, having devoted themselves to this knowledge, have attained to my being, sadharmya, are neither born at the time of creation nor troubled at the time of dissolution. So we find the scriptures, all the different spiritual religious traditions, that they all have their own understanding of what happens when this life ends. This is the great mystery of the Katha Upanishad. We find with Nachiketa and Yama, this was the one thing, such an intelligent young boy, the one thing he wanted to know, what happens? What happens after death? It's such a tremendous mystery if we think about it. We hardly know anything about life. Why we're born, what we're doing here, what the purpose of it is, and then does it just end at the end? Does something continue? It's a tremendous mystery. If we like, we go by what our faith tradition teaches us. Otherwise, we keep an open mind, and we have some understanding that it's going to be better than this. That's our hope, that there won't be all the physical pain and mental suffering and everything else that we find. So this is one idea we find, that this final liberation, whether it's some eternal life in heaven or something like that, that it's meant to counteract this life of suffering and pain here. It's meant to give us some hope. We have our communist metaphysics also. They have their metaphysics that this is really what keeps us from fomenting revolution and anarchy and everything, that this is that opioid that is being dangled in front of us. Well, don't worry how bad it is here. Things will be better later. So this pie-in-the-sky idea, there's a lot of truth to this also. This was a big part of the tradition of slavery in this country. The slaves were told, yes, yours is a life of suffering, but it's okay because you'll go to heaven and then you'll enjoy everything there. Don't expect to enjoy it here, you'll enjoy it there. And it was meant to keep people down. So a lot of, there is a social element to all of these ideas also. But this idea of liberation, something that will keep us from having to go through all of this over and over and over again. We're like high school kids who can't get out of the 12th grade. We keep failing, we keep going over and over, but we will eventually. That everyone will have to graduate eventually. So now we have this basic split. We've seen that this on this one side, these ideas of the heavens and hells and everything, these have their something very positive and something a little bit negative to them. They may seem a little simplistic and childlike to us. They may seem contradictory, this idea that we can get an eternal result from a finite cause. This idea that each culture will look upon this idea of heaven a little differently. Swamiji says that, yeah, look at the people who live in this very arid, desert land. What is their idea of heaven? Lush green gardens with the beautiful fruits hanging down everywhere, because it's what they don't have. So there is a tremendous subjective element to this, of course. So we can say that the non-dualistic idea is a little bit childlike, a little bit simplistic. The dualistic idea. The non-dualistic idea, we can also say is very hard to comprehend. That can we really understand ourselves as being merged in Brahman? What does it mean? Will it be any experience at all? How different will it be from just going to sleep? Huh? Many people think that. What is death like? It means you just go to sleep. It may mean that the soul is still there, but sleeping. Is there any real experience there? So all of these things are very, very difficult for us to understand. And I want to go back to my initial point that there's something a little bit self-centered about this. If this is all we're after, it means we don't care about anybody else or anything else. This is why this is balanced by Swamiji's other idea. So the working for the welfare of others is also a part of this aim of life, this dual principle that we have. So if we regard liberation as the only thing worth striving for, and that this is what Swamiji meant by that, then of course we can object to it. And we find that Sri Ramakrishna never talked about this. We find that Swamiji in so many places didn't like this idea. So we have to go back to this idea of Jivan Mukti. And I think that this, we can all agree, I hope we can all agree, that when we say that liberation is the goal of life, it means enlightenment, it means realization, it means somehow casting off this maya, this ignorance, this veil of ignorance that we're operating under, and realizing the truth, realizing who we really are. And this is what we're all striving to do. If it's more in the idea of the personal God, then we want to have some experience of the divinity in a personal form also, but here and now. So this is what we call Jivan Mukti, liberation in this very lifetime. It can happen at any moment. Does our life come to an end? We can live for many years in this state of pure freedom. How do we live? Like the dried leaf being blown here and there by our past karma, by the will of God, however we understand it. As long as there's this, what they call prarabdha karma, as long as that remains, the body will remain. But we're unaffected by anything then. So this is the state of perfect freedom in this very lifetime, here and now. Freedom from what? From bondage, from ignorance, from delusion, from selfishness, from the passions, all of the things that bind us, all of the things that make us feel small and limited, all of the things that make us miserable. It's not, we can't blame external things for being miserable. This is a catalyst, of course. But we have lost the ability to rise above things. We're so easily affected by everything that this represents our bondage. This fragile, easily bruised ego. If we can get beyond all of these things, then we can realize the truth here and now. So this is the state, Jivanmukti, that comes after some type of illumination, some type of realization of ourself as unborn, undying, as eternal, unchanging, all of these things. And on the other hand, as one with each and everyone, and with God, all together. So this again brings in this idea of working for the welfare of others as worshiping God dwelling within all beings, as seeing ourselves reflected in all beings. So after this experience, we live in the world as free souls, not bound by anything, not planning or scheming for the future, no personal interest in anything. If we have goals, they're all out of compassion and love. That we're finished with personal desires because we're fulfilled. There's nothing that we need, nothing that we want. We have everything. Achieving the end of desire doesn't mean fulfilling desires. It means eliminating them. It means that these become superfluous. We have something far greater. You may remember this story. It was either Rupa or Sanatan, one of the disciples of Chaitanya Dev. He was supposed to have in his possession this Parashmani, this philosopher's stone, or whatever they call it, this Chintamani, that if you take any base metal and you touch it to it, that turns into gold. So it was a very valuable thing. So somebody heard about this, and he said, I have to find this guy and see if I can get this. So he made the long trip. He went to Vrindavan. He found Rupa or Sanatan. I don't remember. Who was it?
Sanatan.
And he said, I hear that you have this stone that if you touch any base metal to it, it turns into gold. Is it true? And he thinks for a minute and he says, let me think. Yeah, I think I do have something like that. I think it's over there hidden in the high grass, something like that. And he said, can I have it? He said, yeah, what do I want it for? I don't need that. So he was overjoyed. He went and he looked and he found it and he took it away. He could become tremendously wealthy. Touching anything to it, it turned into gold. And then he thought to himself, what does Sanatan have that is so valuable that he thinks this is a worthless thing? So he goes back to him. He says, I want that. I want that you have that is so wonderful that you don't care at all whether you have this or you don't have it. So that other desire for wealth and enjoyment and pleasure, that gets eliminated when we have that one thing that fulfills us forever, once and for all. And that's within our hearts. We don't find that anyplace else. We find that by turning within. So we have beautiful descriptions of the state of perfect freedom. There's a Sthita Prajna section of Gita chapter 2. Swami Brahmarupananji has been giving a beautiful series on that. This is a perfect illustration of the free soul, how they live in the world, unperturbed by anything, seeing the same in all beings, filled with joy, going deep within, perfectly calm, equanimous. This is a beautiful idea that we have. This later in Gita, also the description of the soul who's gone beyond the three gunas. We have all of these great descriptions. Sri Ramakrishna, as I mentioned before, he liked this idea that we live in the world, Shushka Parnavat. This is another verse from Ashtavakra Samhita, the dried leaf in the wind. In parts of India, they'll have these big feasts. Everyone will sit outside and there'll be banana leaf or some other leaf that they'll use, and they'll put the food on it, and everyone will eat the food, and it'll be stuck. There'll be a little doll and other things there, and it'll stay there for a while, and day after day, either cows will come or it'll just stay there, and it'll dry up, and it'll get very light, or there's no doll, anything left on it, and if the wind comes, you'll see that it gets blown all over the place. So he says we should live in the world like this dried leaf in a windstorm. It doesn't decide where to go. Wherever the wind blows it, it goes. So what is this wind? We can say it's either our past karma or whatever circumstance arises If someone is in need and they come to us, we help them. We don't go out looking for them. We don't deny anybody. We don't seek anybody. We just live just with perfect freedom. Whatever comes, it comes. It doesn't come, it doesn't come. We don't care. So we have these beautiful ideas of this Jivan Mukta, how the Jivan Mukta lives in the world. Now, Swamiji will make a very strong distinction between this final liberation and this enlightened state. There's a beautiful book that was written by Swami Nirvanananda called Devloka Kotha. He was a disciple of Swami Brahmananda and one of the vice presidents of our order. He writes, "One's own happiness and one's own mukti alone were never the goal of a Thakur Ma Swamiji or Maharaj." That means Swami Brahmananda, Swami Vivekananda, Sri Ramakrishna, Holy Mother. "That is why Swamiji gave us this great mantra." Now look at this. He's saying that one's own mukti is not the goal. And this is how I was explaining this motto of the order. "That is why Swamiji has given us this great mantra, Atmano Mokshartam Jagad Hitaya Cha." So it's very counterintuitive. He's saying, he told us we should seek our own liberation because he never saw this, never wanted us to seek our own liberation. Right? So what he really means is that we should seek this truth, this enlightenment. And you see, we have this new seal of the order. This goes with the motto of the order, the seal of the order. This was given to us by Swami Sridharanandaji in Australia about a year and a half ago. And I really didn't know where to put it and what to do with it, so I kind of delayed and everything. But then we all thought, we tried it above Thakur Shrine. It was too big. So anyhow, we decided to put it here. Yeah, this is very nice. So we see this distinction now between mukti as personal salvation, getting out of this world, all of that, and as freedom from bondage and ignorance. And it's this latter sense where it ceases to have any selfishness to it. Now, people will say it's selfish. We're striving for enlightenment. I think everybody gets this a little bit, that if somebody calls you and says, "Can you have dinner tomorrow night?" And you say, "No, I'm having dinner with somebody else." They say, "Fine." If you say, "No, that's my meditation time," they'll say, "Ah, how selfish. You won't even give that up." Right? But it's really not. And we find that when it really comes, this longing for liberation, the Vyakulata, there's really this terrible urge for liberation. There's nothing premeditated about it. It captures somebody. It grabs hold of somebody. They have no choice about it. We look at all of the direct disciples. We look at Sri Ramakrishna, his 12 years of sadhana, the spiritual practice. Can you say he was being selfish? He had no choice. It was as if the Divine Mother had grabbed him by the hair on his head and pulled him. So when this happens, then forget about this idea that there's anything selfish about it. We realize that we can't do anything in this world. Life isn't worth living for us or for other people if we're constantly being blown back and forth like a ship without a rudder, without this higher knowledge and this understanding of who we are. There's a wonderful small book called The Teachings of Swami Vivekananda. This is the book that turned my life around. This is the first book that I read about Swamiji. It contains excerpts from the complete works. That means all of his lectures, his writings, his letters, and everything. And it puts them according to different categories. And one of the categories, one of the small chapters, is called Freedom and Mukti, Salvation. And I went through this, and there are 26 entries, and all of them represent, you know, the highest teachings that Swamiji has on this subject. Not a single one has anything to do with putting an end to this round of birth and death. Not a single one. None of them have anything to do with this final liberation idea. So for Swamiji, everything was about the attainment of freedom here and now. This was mukti to him. I'll read a few of the excerpts. "The idea of freedom is the only true idea of salvation. Freedom from everything, the senses, whether of pleasure or pain, from good as well as evil. If we give up our attachment to this little universe of the senses or of the mind, we shall be free immediately. The only way to come out of bondage is to go beyond the limitations of law, to go beyond causation. Then blessedness, eternal peace arising from perfect freedom, is the highest conception of religion underlying all the ideas of God in Vedanta. Absolute, free existence, not bound by anything. No change, no nature, nothing can produce a change in him. The same freedom is in you and in me and is the only real freedom. So this is what Swamiji always emphasized. This is, to me, what this Atmano Moksha means. It doesn't mean that we're trying to get out of this world, that may I not be born. Thakur also didn't like that. He said this was a very cowardly type of attitude. That afraid of this, afraid of that, getting caught in everything. He wanted us to be bold, that we're already perfect, we're already free. We have to realize it. We have to realize it here and now. Forget about what comes after this lifetime. Once we have that real freedom, then we can say, I don't care, I can be born again and again, it doesn't matter. So this was Swamiji's idea. He wanted us to be real heroes. He remarked once, when I used to roam about all over India in my sadhana stage, I passed many days in solitary caves and meditation, and many a time decided to starve myself to death because I could not attain mukti. Now I have no desire for mukti, for liberation. That means this final liberation. I do not care for it so long as one single individual in the universe remains without attaining it. This Swamiji was a Buddha. This is the heart of the Buddha. We don't care for our own liberation as long as there are others who are living in darkness that way. So Swamiji was the exact opposite. So many times he talked about being born again and again. The exact opposite. He didn't care to put an end to all of this. He said, I'm willing to be born 1,000 times to help even a dog. And then his most famous remark, this was in the letter to Mary Hale, and may I be born again and again and suffer thousands of miseries so that I may worship the only God that exists, the only God I believe in, the sum total of all souls. And above all, my God the wicked, my God the miserable, my God the poor of all races, of all species, is the special object of my worship. So we see very clearly there's a very sharp distinction between these two different types of liberation, even though one leads to the other. We get this liberation, this illumination now. That means we won't be born again unless we want to. This is a bodhisattva ideal. If we keep some little desire to help others there, we can be born again. This is the real hero who does this. And this is what Sri Ramakrishna taught. And those few people who thought that Swamiji's teachings were contrary to Sri Ramakrishna's teachings, really it just involves a little bit of very clearly looking at some of these teachings that Sri Ramakrishna rarely talked about liberation, putting an end to rebirth and all of that. He wanted us to experience that freedom and that realization here and now also. And then to enjoy the play of the mother. His attitude looks a little bit different, but fundamentally there's no difference. And what I mentioned before about eating sugar, Thakur quoted that so many times. This is from a Ram Prasad song, I want to become sugar. I don't want to become sugar, I want to taste sugar. That is, I don't want to merge in the Supreme Brahman. And that's also not after death, that means here and now. Because his mind would go up into that nirvikalpa samadhi state. He wanted to keep it a little bit lower to enjoy this divine play of the mother and the company of the devotees. So he used to repeat another Ram Prasad song. Ram Prasad says, I bow my head before both liberation and enjoyment. Knowing the truth that Kali is one with Brahman, I discard both dharma and dharma. So this was the heroic attitude that Sri Ramakrishna liked. He didn't care for people who only worried about their own spiritual growth, their own spiritual welfare, trying to escape the world. He compared them to amateur dice players that are always trying to score the most points. Well, he said the experts, they can get whatever they want. Give me a six, they'll throw it, so they'll get a six. So he used to say the rishis of old were timid people. They only wanted to get out. They only cared about their own liberation. He wanted these heroes like Swamiji. I don't care. Let me be born again if necessary. I want to see other people suffering so much in this world. What can I do to relieve their suffering? This is why that second half of the motto can be removed from our understanding of the first half. So Swamiji emphasized this so much. We read the letters that he wrote back to his brother disciples because they had spent, you know, so many long years in deep meditation, forgetting the world, just trying to realize the truth within. He wrote to one of his brother disciples, I don't know, this is the test. He who was Ramakrishna's child does not seek his personal good. There is no time to care for name or fame or mukti or bhakti. Swamiji had a disciple. He was actually Holy Mother's disciple from receiving mantra, but Swamiji gave him sannyasa, Swami Virajananda. He had asked him to preach, to go and to East Bengal on a lecture tour. He was a young Swami, and he felt that he had nothing to say to anybody, that he hadn't attained anything. Everyone quotes Thakur, and without the badge of authority, how can we give lectures? Everyone who wants to get out of giving lectures, we all did it. I did it so many times. Swamiji said, forget it. You have to do it. So he didn't want to do it. So he said, and his reply was that he preferred to practice spiritual disciplines in order to attain salvation. It's like waving a red flag in front of Swamiji. So Swamiji thundered, you will go to hell if you seek your own salvation. Seek the salvation of others if you want to reach the highest. Kill out the desire for personal mukti. This is the person who is saying mokshartam, the goal of life to attain this mukti. Kill out the desire for personal mukti. This is the greatest of all spiritual disciplines. Now, it's a little bit late, but I want to finish. I want to read a beautiful, one of my favorite quotes from Swamiji. About how this tremendous longing that comes upon people for God realization is not a selfish thing. It's not a selfish thing unless we're doing it to escape our duties and other things, but sometimes in a lifetime it'll come upon somebody so strongly that there's no choice. We're helpless, that we have to dive deep into spiritual practice. And Swamiji always pointed to the life of Buddha, this tremendous longing for truth, so strong that everyone will say how selfish. He left a wife and a small child there, but he was helpless there. So I want to read this beautiful quote, and then we'll sit for a few minutes. On the one side, therefore, is the bold assertion that this is all nonsense, that this is Maya, but along with it, there is the most hopeful assertion that beyond Maya, there is a way out. On the other hand, practical mentalists, don't bother your heads about such nonsense as religion and metaphysics. Live here. This is a very bad world indeed, but make the best of it. Which put in plain language means, live a hypocritical, lying life, a life of continuous fraud, covering all sores in the best way you can. Go on putting patch after patch until everything is lost. And you are a mass of patchwork. This is what is called practical life. Those that are satisfied with this patchwork will never come to religion. Religion begins with a tremendous dissatisfaction with the present state of things, with our lives, and a hatred, an intense hatred for this patching up of life, an unbounded disgust for fraud and lies. He alone can be religious who dare say, as the mighty Buddha once said under the Bo tree, when this idea of practicality appeared before him, and he saw it was nonsense, and yet could not find a way out. When the temptation came to him to give up his search after truth, to go back to the world and live the old life of fraud, calling things by wrong names, telling lies to oneself and to everybody. He, the giant, conquered it and said, "Death is better than a vegetating, ignorant life. It is better to die on the battlefield than to live a life of defeat." This is the basis of religion. When a person takes this stand, he is on the way to find the truth. He is on the way to God. That determination must be the first impulse towards becoming religious. I will hew out a way for myself. I will know the truth or give up my life in the attempt. For on this side, it is nothing. It is gone. It is vanishing every day. The beautiful, hopeful young person of today is the veteran of tomorrow. Hopes and joys and pleasures will die like blossoms with tomorrow's frost. This is one side. On the other, there are the great charms of conquest, victories over all the ills of life, victory over life itself, the conquest of the universe. On that side, men can stand. Those who dare, therefore, to struggle for victory, for truth, for religion, are in the right way. And that is what the Vedas preach. Be not in despair. The way is very difficult, like walking on the edge of a razor, yet despair not. Arise, awake, and find the ideal, the goal.